Mark.
Okay. We're studying the book of Genesis. I'm on page 92. I call this chapter, Abraham Tries to Save Lot Again. But who can save Lot from Lot? Genesis 18:16. Then the men arose up from there and looked down towards Sodom. And Abraham was walking with them to send them off. Remember that Abraham had visitors come in the evening. They appeared out of the desert, and Abraham saw them as visitors and to offer them hospitality, prepared a meal for them, served them. Turned out to be God and a couple angels, and there was a conversation about Isaac being born next year. And also, just a general recommitment of God to the culture, to the commitment to Abraham's covenant. So as they were leaving, they looked down towards Sodom, and Abraham was walking with them to send them off. He's still being hospitable. The Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Since Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed." We are designed to be God's stewards in the earth. And stewards have a working and submitted relationship to God as the Father, the creator of the universe. And God is recognizing Abraham as one of his stewards, an important one. He said, "I'm going to bless the whole earth through him, so I should tell him what I'm getting ready to do. I should bring him into the conversation. For I have chosen him in order that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice," that right relationship and justice, "in order that he, the Lord, may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken about him." So he's from him is going to flow all this understanding and knowledge to his children, to his descendants and whatever, about right relationship and justice. Justice speaking to love my neighbor as myself kind of thing. But justice. And it's appropriate because they're going to Sodom and Gomorrah where injustice is going on. The Lord said, "The outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great. Their sin is exceedingly great. I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to its outcry, which has come to me. And if not, I will know." Now, how many of y'all realize God knows exactly what's happening in Sodom and Gomorrah? But he's talking to Abraham, and he's personifying himself in such a way that Abraham can relate to him. He said, "I'm going down to see if this rumor that I've heard is true, and if not, I will know." God, the Bible, God does that a lot in the Bible. He relates to us as if he's human. Then the men turned away from there and went toward Sodom, while Abraham was still standing before the Lord. The men are, as we will hear later, angels. And Abraham came near and said, "Wilt thou indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city, wilt thou indeed sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of 50 righteous who are in it?" Abraham is treading upon his relationship with the Lord. They've agreed to be friends, and even though Abraham is well aware that God is higher than he is, he, for the sake of his mercy for the people in Sodom and Gomorrah, one of which, one family happens to be his nephew, said, "You know, Lord, if there are 50 righteous people there, you wouldn't take it out, would you? Far be it from thee to do such a thing and to slay the righteous with the wicked so that the righteous and the wicked are treated alike. Far be it from thee. Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly?" Abraham is challenging God's ethics. He's saying, you wouldn't do that. That would be unjust. It would be unmerciful for sure. So the Lord said, "Well, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare the whole place on their account." Now, he already knows how many righteous there are in the city. You know, there's four, and only one of those is serious about it. Abraham answered and said, "Now behold, I have ventured to speak to the Lord. I've really stepped down on a limb, although I'm but dust and ashes." He's posturing himself rightly before God. "Suppose the 50 righteous are lacking five, wilt thou destroy the whole city because of five?" Now, these people are good at bargaining. He didn't say, "What about if there's 45? He said, "What if you're only missing five? You know, it's the five you should see. It's such a small number." Instead of, "Well, what about 45?
He was Jewish, right?
You think. Well, he wasn't actually, but that's okay. Suppose the 50 righteous are lacking five, without destroy the whole city of five. And he, that's God, said, I will not destroy if I find 45 there. I know what you're saying, Abraham. It's 45, you know, not minus five. Yep.
Are we supposed to glean from this that Abraham is actually negotiating with God?
He's trying to. He's trying to. He's trying to negotiate with...
Why would God even care?
Because God loves him. Because God is relating to us as stewards, and he treats us as if we're family. God loves Abraham extraordinarily, and you too. I mean, when we pray, we're negotiating with God. But Abraham is going at it pretty tooth and nail. And I'm not surprised at all that God would do that. Because there are people God particularly likes because of who they are, like Enoch, for instance. But no, Abraham cares. Abraham could say, no skin off my back, you know. They're a bunch of sluggards anyway. You know, I had to go rescue them before with the army and whatever. But he cares for these people because they're people. And God said, I will not destroy it for 45 there. He spoke to him yet again and said, suppose 40 are found there. And he said, I will not do it on account of 40. And he said, oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I shall speak. Suppose 30 are found there. He's testing the waters to see when God's going to bow up on him. He said, I will not do it if I find 30 there. And he said, now behold, I have ventured to speak, Lord. Suppose 20 are found there. So you think he's negotiating? I think he's negotiating. Found there. And he said, I will not destroy it on account of 20. And he said, oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I shall speak only this once. Suppose 10 are found there. This is my last time I want to bug you about this. Suppose there are 10 righteous people there. And he said, I will not destroy it on account of 10. As soon as he had finished speaking to Abraham, the Lord departed and Abraham returned to his place. We're talking about Abraham bargaining. What is Abraham's bargaining chip? What is it?
Relationship.
Abraham's bargaining chip is, I will think well of you. I will think well of you if you don't do these things. It'll be a blessing to my friendship with you. He's treading on his friendship. And he's asking God for special favors, for blessings. There are some things you can ask of your friends, and some things you can't even ask of your friends. They're too personal, but you might ask for them with a close family member or something. I remember some movie I was with. I can almost picture which one it was. Oh, yeah, well, I think it was Downton Abbey. But what happened is that, what's her name, the Dowager Empress, She was saying to. They thought maybe that Mary's reputation was going to be ruined, and she said, "You know, we can send her to America. They're not that crazy." You can sometimes find a Spaniard who's not too picky, you know. But anyway, at one point or something, she was talking about somebody doing something, and she said, "Oh, that's that kind of imposition. You can't ask of a friend. It's got to be a family member for that kind of imposition." So she was saying there are certain levels of things that you have to ask. Well, Abraham is going all out here to try to bargain with God based on their relationship, and basically he's saying, I will think very highly of you if you are this merciful. And God cares. Now, God, of course, is bargaining pretty strong hand because he knows how many are there. But anyway, so Abraham demonstrates the messianic grace that sets godly men apart from religious men. Messianic grace. He cares for other people more than for himself. Messianic grace. He lays his life down for the sake of someone else. Abraham goes out with an army of 318 men against five large armies, puts himself at risk because he cares for them. There are Moses, for instance, was constantly begging God not to destroy the people of Egypt. God would say stuff like, you know, step back, I'm going to wipe them out and we're going to start over. And Moses would get down on his knees and beg God not to do it and remind God that if he was really gracious, he wouldn't do that. But he put himself at risk for the sake of other people. That's the messianic nature coming through here. He lays down his life for his neighbors who live down in Sodom and Gomorrah. He cares for the well-being of sinners, and even for Lot, who has dishonored him twice. Lot cut himself off from Abraham twice when he could have gone back to Abraham and didn't. Once when they got to arguing over wells, because his shepherds and all of his hired men were fighting over with Abraham's over wells. And then when Abraham goes out and rescues him and brings him back, Lot had the opportunity to say, "Father Abraham, I have been wrong. I need to come home and submit myself to you." But he doesn't. He moves back into Sodom and Gomorrah. So Abraham, we would understand it if he went, well, he made his bed, let him lay in it. But he doesn't. He cares for Lot, even though Lot does not honor him. Abraham continues to show hospitality by escorting his guest. I said that. God decides to take Abraham into his counsel because God and Abraham are friends, and because Abraham is hospitable. He's a good guy. He's worthy. God likes him. He admires him. I've said this before. I want to be a friend of God. I want to be God's friend. I want God to think well of me as a friend. You know, I like Wayne. He's full of crap sometimes, but I like him. You know, he's a friend. And you do too. The good news is that such a relationship is available to every one of us. The relationship that God has here with Abraham, whereby they sit and have meals together and chit-chat and talk about this and that, and where, you know, Sarah can laugh at God and he doesn't get mad about it, where Abraham can find the courage somewhere to negotiate, bargain with God for the sake of other people who deserve whatever it is they're getting. That's a friendship. Abraham is a man who must teach his people both the principles of righteousness and justice. He is the significant progenitor of all believers. He is the father of all faith believers. And so he's a significant steward. He challenges God's ethics, a bold action only a significant friend could get away with. God will sweep away the righteous with the wicked. God lets Abraham negotiate all the way down to 10 righteous people. So what is the connection between loving one's neighbor and being God's friend? Well, if you are, you know, what are the two great commandments? Put God first and love your neighbor. They're tied. If you love God, you must love your neighbor. You must love your neighbor. God spares the wicked sometimes for the sake of the righteous, but there is a limit. There are all manner of times when God does not judge for the sake of the righteous. And the wicked get spared in the process. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting in this gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, bowed down his face to the ground, and he said, "Now behold, my lords, please turn aside into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet, and then you will rise early and get on your way." So Lot is out at the city gate waiting for travelers to come in order to show them hospitality. Where did he learn that? Abraham, that's right. He's doing that because he knows that if they stay in the city streets, that they will have a bad, bad night. And he hates it with all of his heart. He thinks it's wrong. He doesn't hate it enough to move away because he's too entrapped by it. His family is too entrapped by it. But he hates it. And they said, "No, we'll spend the night in the square. We're in and out pretty fast. We're just going to spend the night in the square." He urged them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house. He prepared a feast for them, and he baked unleavened bread, and they ate. So here he is. He's making them a meal. Where did he get that? Abraham. Before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, and all the people from every corner. And they called to Lot and said, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them." Is that blunt enough for you? Mm-hmm. "Bring them out so that we can have sex with them. They're strangers, fresh meat in town. Bring them out." But Lot went out to the doorway and shut the door behind him, and he said, "Please, my brothers, do not act wickedly. Now behold, I have two daughters who have not had relationships with man. Please let me bring them out to you and do with them whatever you like." We'll get there in just a minute. I know jaws are hitting the table there. "Only do nothing to these men, inasmuch as they have come under the shelter of my roof. They're under my hospitality." That's a huge value in this world, larger than the well-being of your children. We'll get to that. But they said, "Stand aside." Furthermore, they said, "This one came in as an alien, and already he's acting like a judge. Now we will treat you worse than them." Said, "Who is this guy who thinks he can prevent us from having a good time? Shoot, we'll just drag him and his family out and enjoy them too." So they pressed hard against Lot and came near to break down the door. But the men reached out their hands, that would be the angels, and brought Lot back into the house with them and shut the door. So just the fog came over these guys, and the angels grabbed them and brought them back in. And they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves trying to find the door. The implication here is not that they all went physically blind, but that they couldn't see. They couldn't see what was right in front of them. It just couldn't get there. I think if they'd all been struck blind, they'd probably been running off home trying to get the doctor or something. But they stuck them so they dealt with them so that they couldn't see what was right in front of them. Revelation is a gift from God, and He gives it to those who seek Him. Then the men said to Lot, the angels, that is, "Who else have you here? Who belongs to you here besides your wife and these two daughters? A son-in-law and your sons, your daughters, and whoever you have in the city, bring them out in this place, for we are about to destroy this place, because their outcry has been great before the Lord, that the Lord has sent us to destroy it." So if you've got any family in this town besides what we see here, then go get them, and we will take them out with you. We will, for your sake, we will save these people. And Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-laws who were to marry his daughter. Now this is important. Lot knew that his daughters, were engaged to men in the town. And so he went to them and he said, "We're getting ready to get dumped on by God, so you all want to come with us because there's angels in our house and they're here to save us." And they said, "What are you smoking, Lot?" "Up, get out of this place," he said, "for the Lord will destroy the city." But he appeared to his son-in-laws to be jesting. They didn't hear it. They didn't get it. Eyes that can't see and ears that can't hear. So righteous Lot shows hospitality to strangers. And it saves him in the short run. He offers them foot washing, food, shelter, and safety. Lot knew what would happen if they stayed in the streets. We know what happens if people stay in the streets. Unlike Lot's action toward visitors, unlike Abraham's action toward visitors, the men of the town violated hospitality in the worst possible way. They wanted to rape visitors and rob them and probably kill them. This falls into the category of are you loving your neighbor or not? We hear about these two great commandments: love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and body, and love your neighbor as yourself. We think the love neighbor is a toss-off. You know, it's love God, and oh, by the way, love your neighbor too. The Bible constantly shows us that loving our neighbor is equal in importance to loving God. That one flows from the other, and the other verifies the first. This is extraordinarily important. And the abuse of hospitality is one of the worst ways to demonstrate whatever the opposite of love of neighbor is. The giving of hospitality is a very strong way to show what love of neighbor is. Now, Jesus talked about the Good Samaritan, who a man was going from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among thieves, remember? And they stripped him and beat him and took what he had and threw him in the ditch. And a priest of Israel came by, and he saw him and went on his way. And a Levite, two religious men came by and saw him. And then a Samaritan, one of those who were hated by the Jews, one of those the Jews said were dogs, said they were people of no faith and no conscience and just scumbags. The Samaritan comes by, and this Samaritan sees the guy there, and he has compassion for him. He has a heart toward this man. He sees a neighbor who is his enemy. He can tell this guy's a Jew. He's naked. So he goes down to the ditch, and he binds up his wounds and covers him up and puts him on whatever it is he's got for donkey or whatever, and takes him to a nearby inn. They don't have hospitals, emergency rooms, or dock on the boxes. He takes him to an inn, a hotel. And he says to the innkeeper, "I'm going to pay you for 7 nights. And I'm also going to pay you money so you feed this guy. And when I come back, if there's more, if I don't get back in time, I will pay you that as well." And so he does this for his enemy, somebody whose people have constantly treated him and his people as if they're subclass. And so Jesus says to them pointedly, "Who was neighbor to that man?" And they said, "Well, the one who helped him." They couldn't even say Samaritan. The one who helped him. The Levite and the priest were not neighbor to him, but the Samaritan was neighbor. Jesus said that right after he was telling the Jews that the greatest commandment is to love God, and the second is like it, to love your neighbor as yourself. And they were going, well, who do I have to love then? Who? I mean, define who I have to love as myself. And so he tells them the story about a man who is neighbor to his worst enemy. And he says, these priests, these holy men, these religious men who went by, they were not neighbor to their own kind. This Samaritan was. So we have this whole thing about neighbor, and we have this hospitality. They did not recognize Lot's hospitality responsibilities. This is the men of the city. They were ready to treat Lot in the same way as they planned to treat his guest. Now, in recent years, people have assumed that the reason that God nuked Sodom and Gomorrah was homosexuality. It never says that. It never says that. The reason given in the scriptures for why God nuked Sodom and Gomorrah is their failure to care for their neighbor, is their violation of their neighbor requirements. They not only did not care for their neighbor, but they were abusing them, and not just sexually. It wasn't, you know, we've made this into a homosexual thing. It's not. In fact, we have the word sodomize, which means like they did in Sodom, and it talks about a sexual event. But that is not the only thing, or even the most important thing, for which they were judged. We've made it that way. At any rate, they were judged because they failed to be neighbor. They failed to be neighbor. When the Israelites were confronted by Isaiah in the third chapter, the Lord said to the people of Israel, I'm going to haul you off in captivity because you failed to be neighbor. Up until now, what's happened is you were violating your idolaters. But now you have become systematically anti-neighbor. You've changed the laws to steal from the poor. Your people are out consuming rather than caring for the poor. They're spending money to put knickknacks in their house rather than feeding the poor. You're treating the poor as if they are slaves or aliens in exile. And so what you do unto them will be done unto you. I'm hauling you off because you failed to care for your neighbor. That's why they got hauled off. The penalty for idolatry is eyes that can't see and ears that can't hear. What happens is you become stupid in your thinking. God gives you over to a depraved mind, so that you can't see or see God anymore or whatever, until you turn around and say and start seeking Him again. That's the penalty for idolatry, is you become stupid and you walk yourself straight into hell. But the penalty for the violation of your neighbor is that whatever you do to them will be done to you. And so off you go into captivity because you violated your neighbor by failing to care for them when you should have, by passing laws to steal from them because you could, etc., etc. This passage is designed for us to understand that. In recent years, it's become misdirected into homophobic explanation, but only in recent years. Yes?
Whenever I read this passage, I wonder if Lot recognized these men as something more than men and possibly angels, or and thus was even more welcoming and more like, well, I want to jump in and protect you and bring you into my house, and, or not. I mean, it's a challenging...
I understand the question. It's a good question. Let me suggest to you what I think about that. When he told them to come and stay in his house, he said, you need to do that because you could get hurt in the streets. So he didn't think they were angels at that point. Because if he knew they were angels, he wouldn't have worried about them getting hurt in the streets. Now, when they're in the house, and he offers to protect them by even offering out his daughters, he doesn't see them as men who have the power to protect him and his family. It is not until they reach out and grab him and pull him in and strike these guys blind and tell him, we're going to deliver you, that they realize these are supernatural beings. Does that help?
It does. The other question, that's great, actually. The other question, too, is you know, you find yourself thinking, clearly Lot knows that this place is a mess. And you mentioned him being trapped there. I tried to picture in my head what kept him there. I'm assuming he was living large. I mean, he had like a great house or something. It would be the trappings of of what his lifestyle was there?
We're told in Hebrews that Lot was vexed in his righteous soul day after day. And, of course, the question is, why didn't he move? When you look at the evidence, what you see is part of what you're saying. They moved down to be near Sodom and Gomorrah because of the advantages it offered. Then they moved into Sodom and Gomorrah because advantages. You know, you got the opera and you got the football team, whatever. Do they have a nice house? Apparently it's nice. His daughters are marrying, you know, those people. You see a very strong influence of his women on him concerning this town. So he's captured, they're captured. You can see, for instance, her looking back later like, I don't want to leave this place. You can see the daughters manifesting the morals of the place. We'll get to that too. So yeah, he's captured in an environment, in a culture, because he wants the goodies in that culture. But yet he acknowledges that the culture, he despises the culture because it vexes his righteous soul day by day. It's a great question because here's the deal. We live in a culture that we sometimes despise and hate because of how ugly it is. Why don't we move? And I don't mean physically move. Why don't we leave that culture and move into the kingdom of heaven? Why don't we systematically abandon those things? Well, one reason is because it's been too easy to flow in the culture and enjoy the way the culture works. You also don't want to become thought of as ridiculous by the culture because that's going to minimize your advantages and whatever. There's a certain habitual thing about it, an inertia. You know, Lot's here and he's here and he's here and there's an inertia about it. He hasn't gotten bad enough yet that he's choking on his vomit. Looks like it's getting there, but you have the pull, for instance, I would love to get out of the culture, but if I do, my family won't join me. Or I'll alienate my family if I do that. So I don't want to make any overt moves that will do that. Peer pressure, our desire for stuff, our failure to have a proper working relationship with the Lord, that it empowers us by the Spirit to do all that. Jackie? Well, let's talk about that a little bit. You know, first of all, you could assume that he was part of the leadership, but there are people who hang out on the gates, whether they're leadership or not. And he could be prominent, but we see pretty quickly that it's pretty shallow because the people who are coming to his door are quite ready to jump him, and they think of him as a stranger. He's not likely to get elected to any offices. I'm not trying to say you're wrong, but it's not real deep. And the stated reason for there is to protect visitors that are coming from that particular place. The other thing is that, remember, this was a man who once had huge flocks and servants, and now he has none of that. So we can assume maybe he cashed all that out and moved into town. Or he's lost it somehow or another. But somewhere in all that is where truth lies. Yeah, he could be living large. He is by a lot of standards.
What's ironic is Trey Arnett's sermon this morning is just on all this.
Was it really? Did he get it right?
Having something and not being able to let go.
Did he get it right?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Really good.
Yeah, Trey's good. Trey likes to make connections with things that are very practical and whatever. And sometimes he bends stuff to get there, but so do I. So anyway, all preachers do that. All right. Lot offers to give them his two virgin daughters in place of his guests. In the famous words of Keanu Reeves, what was I thinking? What is he thinking? How in the world would he come up with this as an answer? Either Lot hoped to shock them into backing off and show them how much he valued the well-being of these men, or Lot's tenure in Sodom had eroded his sense of sexual appropriateness. Women in the ancient world were second-class citizens and economic bargaining chips. So he may be using his daughters as a bargaining chip to save these men and his hospitality. He may be counting on the fact that they were betrothed to two local men, verse 14. And perhaps Lot thought that they would protect them or that they wouldn't be harmed because they were married, a couple of guys in town. Who knows? But he certainly has no qualms about offering them in exchange for safety for his guests. Another way to say this is Lot is treating his guest more as neighbor than he treats his daughters. But remember, in this world, We don't have this affection for children and stuff that we do, because Jesus taught us to do that, and it started there. Remember that Jacob had 12 sons, but 10 of them were just laborers to him. And he used them as such. And only one, Joseph, and Benjamin the spare, the heir and the spare, only those were treated as heirs who were going to wind up with stuff and favored and taught and given education beyond the others, etc., etc. Goodies and stuff. So children are bargaining chips, and that's part of the deal here. Lot is spiraling downward. Lot's life is spiraling downward since he left Abraham's oversight. But he has not yet hit bottom. We've been watching him, like, you know, plane coming down around the sky. And this is a low place, but this isn't bottom yet. We haven't got to bottom. The consequences of this act, offering his daughters like chattel, reverberate all the way to King Solomon's falling away from God. His offering his daughters like chattel reverberates all the way forward to King Solomon's day. It was Solomon's Moabite and Ammonite wives who led him into false sexual worship. 1 Kings. The Moabites and Ammonites were Lot's descendants conceived through incest with his daughters. We'll talk about that more in just a minute. Alrighty. Lot had not had much success as an evangelist. He was in the culture and it was shaping him rather than him shaping it. We have to think about this personally. Are we shaping the culture or is it shaping us? His, you know, Peter told him, save yourself from this perverse wicked generation. You know, one of the problems with being a boiled frog is you don't know you're being boiled, right? And we have been living in this culture very often not realizing how boiled we are becoming, because it just sort of sneaks up on us. It's nice people who lead us into things that aren't pleasing to the Lord, consumerism or, you know, all kinds of things. It's nice people who try to teach us values that are not biblical. It's people who we work with, people we depend upon, people whose approval we want. The culture is pernicious. It's perverse, as Peter said. And we need to save ourselves from it if we expect to enter the kingdom of heaven. His influence in town was minimal. He hadn't done much good evangelism. Instead of being a positive influence on his neighborhood, Lot and his family have become somewhat corrupted by their environment. Actually, pretty corrupted, we'll see. Lot could not even influence his future sons-in-law to leave. He wasn't even taken seriously by them. The angel struck the drunken mob with confusion, giving them eyes that could not see. Confusion is what the blindness they were talking about. Alrighty, when morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city. But he hesitated. So the men seized his hand, the hand of his wife, and the hand of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him. And they brought him out, and they put him outside the city. They drug him out of town, and his wife and two daughters, to save him. Because as much as Lot hated all this, as much as he saw the danger, he just couldn't hardly put his feet in the right directions and go. He certainly didn't flee the city. But he hesitated. So the man seized his hand, the hand of his wife's daughters, two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him, and they brought him out and put him outside the city. It came about that when they brought them outside, that one of them said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you. Do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains, lest you be swept away. But Lot said to them, oh no, my lords, not. Now behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have magnified your loving kindness, your mercy, which you show me by saving my life, but I cannot escape to the mountains, lest disaster overtake me there and I die. Where was it that Lot was having his problems with Abraham? It was in the mountains. You know, who was it that came and drug him off into captivity? The kings of the mountains. Lot's afraid of the mountains. He said, don't send me to the mountains. I can't do that. And he said, then behold, I will grant you, this angel said, I will grant you this request also, not to overthrow the town. I cannot escape the mountains lest disaster overtake me and I die. Now behold, this town is near enough to flee to, and it is small. He's talking about Zoar. He said, there's this town over here. It's far enough away from where you told me the blast site's going to be, and it's small. It's not some big town, whatever. And he said to him, behold, I grant you this request also, not to overthrow the town which you have spoken. If you go to that town, I will spare that town. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything till you arrive there. Therefore, the name of the town was called Zoar. The sun had risen over the earth when Lot came to Zoar. And then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah, brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. Wife from behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Even though the city is falling down around him, Lot had a hard time leaving Sodom. The angels had to force him to leave. He begs to be allowed to go to another city rather than go back to the mountains. Once again, he lacks faith for making it in the mountains. He would have to face Abraham, who lived there. Righteous Lot was in deep trouble, but he was nonetheless proud. His wife had a tougher time leaving Sodom than did Lot. She seems to have been more ensnared there than was Lot. One wonders how much influence she had on the original choice to move to Sodom. She certainly did not inspire faith and morals in her daughters. The judgment on Sodom came when the level of sin was beyond repair. Even the most righteous man in town was being corrupted by it. When the people of God are being corrupted by the culture, by the world, and the world is no longer shaping it, it's the end. Even the prayers of God's best friend, Abraham, could not save it. God waits patiently in hopes that all who will do so, can do so, will repent. When he's had enough, he comes like a thief in the night to execute judgment and justice. The events at Sodom and Gomorrah are indicative of the larger plan. I'm not going to read 2 Peter there because I got to move on quickly. Now Abraham arose early in the morning, and he went to the place where he stood before the Lord. And he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward the land of the valley. And he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of a furnace. And then it came about, when God destroyed the cities of the valleys, that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out in the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities. The destruction of Sodom is a classic nuclear explosion. A white-hot ball of fire sucks the exploded matter into the sky. The result is a mushroom cloud seen for many miles. It's followed by a shower of toxic ash and a huge hole that becomes the Dead Sea. A firestorm proceeds out from it and caramelizes everything in front of it into hardened sodium, a pillar of salt. The Dead Sea is also called the Salt Sea. I'm going to have to quit there, but we'll finish this next week. I'm sorry I can't finish it right now, but we'll do that. You know, I can't prove it's a nuclear attack, but it, you know, that God uses some nuclear mechanism, but it's exactly like that. It's exactly what happened to Hiroshima, only worse.
Can you remark that Abraham was Jewish and you said not yet?
Well, nobody's Jewish until Judaism starts in Babylonian captivity.
Okay.
They're not called Jews. They're Israelites, and he's not even an Israelite yet, because Israelites were named after his grandson. He's just a friend of God.
So it's when they're in Babylon.
Pardon? Yeah. It's not till they get to Babylon that they're called Judeans, which gets sort of anglicized to Jews. Now, when you remember Germany,
yeah.
Judah, J-U-D on the doors.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's the root word for this. So it's why when they're in Babylon, remember the northern kingdom was already hauled off. The only people in Babylon were Judeans. And so they became known as a people as Judeans, Judes, or Jews. That's when they became Jews.
So isn't that why other religions call Abraham their father as well?
Yeah.
Or a church father?
That's true. That's right. That's a good point. Abraham's called the father of many religions, including Christians. Because he's bigger than Jews.
So what is he really?
He's a friend of God.
Well, I meant nationality.
Oh, nationality? He's a Semite. He's a Semite. That's all you can say about him, is he's a Semite. But he is like Noah. He is a man who walks with God, and that's enough. That's enough. Judaism comes later. Anybody else got a question or comment? Somebody please pray us out.